Good morning. Welcome to the second half of the quantum theory course. I believe I know everyone, so please call me Dan. You can find me in office 273, just down the hall. Here's my email. It's also on the website. I will be posting office hours, but feel free to drop by if you have questions or email me to set up an appointment. Happy to discuss the course material at any time. Just let me know. A few comments about the structure of the second half of the course before we get started on the content. So the lecture notes have been posted. They're up near the top of the course website. You'll also notice a large number of quizzes on the course website. Those are for your education, for you to test your understanding. Some of them are quite difficult. If you get them right, you are following along very well. If you have trouble with a particular problem, please discuss with your classmates, with me, or with the TA. The quizzes are designed to be done, and all the content is designed to be done in the order it's listed on the course website. So you notice there's a quiz to do before tomorrow's lecture, additional quizzes to do after tomorrow's lecture. Tomorrow's tutorial as well. The rest of the tutorials and homework for the course are also on the website. Any questions about the logistics before we start on the content? Okay. So I do encourage you to go through all the quizzes. It's not a requirement. I won't be tracking that, but previous students have found those helpful. I hope you do as well. Okay. For the remainder of the course, we have one goal. I'm going to try to answer one question. Is what happens when particles collide? In certain limits, this is a process you already know how to describe. You can roughly think about there as being four different regimes. Depending on whether the incoming particles are big or small or moving fast or slow. So if they're big and slow, you can describe this process using Newtonian physics. Classical mechanics, you studied problems like this in one of your first physics courses. If they're big and fast, we can still treat them classically, but we need relativity. They're small and slow, we can use non-relativistic quantum mechanics, like you studied in the first part of Vindhya's course, Vindhya's part of the course. And our focus is going to be on the remaining quadrant down here. When it's small and fast, we need both quantum mechanics and relativity to describe processes like this collision process. These two theories don't naturally mesh together. So we're going to see that there are some challenges in combining these two theories. You've already discussed some of those challenges with Bindia. We'll discuss further challenges and further ways we can unite these theories. And when doing so, when we're dealing with a relativistic quantum system, there are many new effects that you don't see if you're dealing with just a relativistic system or just a quantum system. And one of the most important and most interesting ones is particle creation and annihilation. If you notice in this diagram, I've drawn two incoming particles and three outgoing particles. That's not an accident. When we combine these two theories, we can get particle creation and annihilation. And the number of particles can increase or decrease in a process. And that's an essential feature of quantum field theory, which is the theory that lives down in this bottom right corner of the diagram. And we'll go and see how to describe this mathematically later in the course. But I'd like to start by just giving you a motivation for why we might expect particle creation and annihilation when we combine relativity and quantum theory. So let's imagine we have a box. With side length L on each side. And here's a particle. Okay. Now, we know that we put this particle in the box, we have some information about the position of the particle. So quantum mechanics tells us that there's an uncertainty in the momentum of this particle. So quantum mechanics tells us that uncertainty momentum greater than or equal to about 1 over L. Now, I've done something that may be unfamiliar to some of you in this equation. What have I done? What have I left off? Ralph.
H bar equals to 1.
H bar equals to 1, yes. So let's do a side note. Throughout this course, we're going to be using natural units where H bar and C are both equal to 1. There are two reasons for this. One is it simplifies a lot of our formulas. We're dealing with relativistic quantum systems. So H bars and Cs are going to be in essentially all of our formulae. So one is for convenience. The second is it will simplify some of the dimensional analysis we will do later in the course and in future courses. In these units, there's only one dimensionful unit left in scientific units with where you have kilograms, meters, and seconds. You can eliminate two of the three using H bar and C. So there's one independent unit left, which is typically chosen to be mass. And every quantity will have a units of mass to some power. We can write the mass dimension of some quantity. So the mass dimension of mass is by definition 1. This means that mass is equal to mass to the first power. But we can write any other quantity as mass to some power. For example, energy can be written as mass to some power in these units. Does anyone know what the mass dimension of energy is?
One.
Why?
Equals mc squared.
Very good. Thanks, Luke. So we know that this equation is dimensionally correct if we set c equal to 1, energy and mass have same units. So we'll be using these units throughout the course. The dimensional analysis part of it will be important later. For now, it's just going to simplify our formulas. Yes,
you're also setting length dimension to 1.
So good question. So what's the mass dimension of length?
1.
Minus 1, why? We have that. So h bar has units kilogram meter squared per second. And our c has meters per second. So these are what we're working with. Can we relate that to mass? So somebody tell me a formula that relates a length to it.
No,
it's
the same for g.
Hc over lambda. Very good. So that's an energy. So 1 over length is the same unit, so it's as energy. Thank you, sir. So that's an aside. We'll come back to this more. You can check your understanding further on the quiz. Okay, so before that rather lengthy aside, we were trying to motivate why we might expect particle creation or annihilation when we combine relativity and quantum mechanics. So our first equation here says that there's an uncertainty in the momentum. We put a particle in a box. We also have, if the momentum is large enough, then the momentum is approximately equal to the energy. Special relativity with p much greater than r. We also know that energy and mass can be interchanged to one another. Again, due to special relativity. And so when we combine these formulae, this suggests that if we make the lengths small enough, eventually the uncertainty in momentum or energy will be larger than 2m. So this suggests, or at least opens the possibility that if we make the box small enough, we might not be sure how many particles are in the box. If the energy can be converted to mass, and the uncertainty in momentum is large enough. So this argument is clearly very sketchy. It's just meant to be motivational. Whether or not particles will be created or annihilated will depend on the details of the experiment and the system. But this suggests that we should at least consider the possibility. And we'll see this more carefully. This, as I mentioned before, this is one of the key features of quantum field theory. This is not something we can see in a non-relativistic system or a quantum system or a relativistic classical system. Okay. So there are new effects we see down here. And as we've seen with Bindiya, the theory that lives in this part is a quantum field theory. And a natural question to ask, why fields? At least the questions we're interested in asking right now are about particles. So there are a number of answers to this question, some of which you'll explore more in the Quantum Field Theory 1 course with Gong, but a few of which I want to touch on, some of which Bindiya has already touched on, I want to elaborate on a bit. My first answer is this question of why do we need fields to combine relativity and quantum theory? Has to do with the failure or superluminal propagation. In single particle relativistic quantum mechanics. So what I mean by this is that if we consider a quantum system with a one-particle quantum system with a Hamiltonian, that's the Hamiltonian of a relativistic particle. Then we can compute the amplitude for a particle to propagate from some initial position at some initial time to some final position at some final time. That amplitude is known as the propagator. So here I'm drawing a space-time diagram, x and t. These are the light cones at some initial point. You can ask what is the amplitude for the particle to propagate from this point to some point outside of the light cone. The propagator or amplitude for this particle to propagate from the initial position to somewhere outside the light cone. We can compute it, and we will compute it tomorrow in tutorial, and show that it's non-zero outside of the light cone. So this is a stronger statement than Bindiya made. So Bindiya made a similar statement for a non-relativistic particle. It's that alone is not a serious problem, but here, the fact that we have a one-particle system that's relativistic that allows superluminal propagation indicates that there's a problem with this approach to combining special relativity and quantum mechanics. So the simplest thing we can try fails. So that's one reason to consider fields, is because if you don't use fields, well, at least the simplest approach is not using field to fail.
Can I somehow take linear combinations of propagators? And perhaps this problem would maybe, I don't know, like cancel out or something like that?
The approach we'll use to resolve that, we'll look at that in more detail tomorrow, but yes, it's related to what you're saying. We need to do slightly more than what you're suggesting to resolve the problem. Thank you. Yaroslav? Okay. So that's my first answer to Y fields. Second answer is locality. We like our physical theories to be local. Action at a distance is not a desirable property. And one of the motivations for introducing fields in classical physics, like the electromagnetic field or gravitational field, is to ensure that the theory is local. The same motivations apply to quantum field theories. And in fact, you can argue that if you combine quantum mechanics with special relativity and add some additional assumptions related to locality, it's not quite a proof, but Gong will go through the argument of why, when we combine these things, it almost implies that you have to end up with a quantum field theory. So this direction is something you'll look at in the QFT1 course with Gong. Once we have a quantum field theory, we can take a classical limit. And end up with a classical field theory. In some sense, this direction is more satisfying. It's also more challenging. So we're going to start from the other direction. We're going to start over here in this course and start with a classical field theory and try to figure out ways we can quantize that. And then we'll see that the quantum field theories we construct have these properties. So this is the direction we'll go in this course. Mathematically and conceptually, going this way is much easier. This way is more satisfying, but I'll leave that to Gong. Also, other reasons that using fields to combine special relativity and quantum mechanics is a good idea, and that it resolves some unexplained features that you may be familiar with for quantum mechanics. And the first is the issue of identical particles. Experimentally, every electron we've ever seen has exactly the same properties, the same mass, the same spin, the same electric charge. We could assume that. That's what you've done so far, and when you've studied non-relativistic quantum mechanics. But a more satisfying explanation for why every electron or every photon in the universe is the same, is that they all come from a single field. Not to the explanation that quantum field theory gives. So in quantum field theory, particles are excitations of fields. In a sense, we'll make mathematically precise later. There's just one field, so it's not. You don't need to make an additional assumption about why all electrons are the same. A second mystery that quantum field theory resolves. It's the relationship between spin and statistics. So, as you all know, particles with integer spin are bosons. So they have commutation relations. Whereas particles with half integer spin are fermions. There is a theorem in quantum field theory that can prove, using basically these assumptions, that guarantees that this is the case. In this course, we're just going to stick with spin zero particles. Gong will walk you through how to generalize what we're doing in this course to higher spin particles. So this is something we won't discuss further in this course, but that you will come back to with Gong. Okay. So those are a few of the reasons why we study quantum field theory. And as I mentioned earlier, our approach in this course is going to be to start with the classical field theory and quantize it. There's many ways to do this, or at least two very important ones. So one approach that you began to study with Bindiya is to take a classical field, which I'll indicate by phi, and quantize it using path integral techniques to promote a classical field to an integration variable. This is a path or functional integral quantization technique. So this you studied with Bindiya in the earlier part of this course. We'll come back to this course, this approach in the QFT2 course. In the remainder of this course, we're going to take a very different approach, different but equivalent approach. We're going to start with classical fields and promote it to an operator. This process is very similar to the first way that many of you saw quantum mechanics, where you start with a classical theory of particles, then you promote the position and momentum to operators. We're going to use a very similar approach here. And this is the same approach Gong will use. So both techniques have their advantages and drawbacks, as we'll see in this course. This is known as canonical quantization. This is path integrals. canonical quantization makes the connection between particles and fields much more clear. It also facilitates proving some exact results in quantum field theory, which are quite rare. So they're generally very important when we can prove something exactly, and we'll touch on a couple of exact results later in this course. The path integral approach also has its advantages as well. One of the big ones that we will discuss in the QFT course is path integrals. It's a much more elegant and usually easier way to deal with gauge theories. So for quantizing electromagnetism or its generalizations, we can do that using canonical quantization, but this way is much more elegant and usually easier. It also facilitates studying some other physical effects that we'll talk about later in the year, in particular cases where traditional perturbation theory fails, so-called non-perturbative effects. Path integrals are often easier. Again, we'll come back to that in some of the elective courses later this year. Okay. So this is the approach we're going to take. And immediately, we run into a problem. And I believe Bindiya discussed this briefly as well. So the problem we encounter is the very different treatment of position and time in quantum mechanics. In non-relativistic quantum mechanics, position is an operator. Time is a parameter used to describe the evolution of the system. And one of your homework questions in the first assignment, you looked at the problems if we try to promote time to an operator. So we have to make a decision how we're going to treat these two objects. So in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, we have a position operator and a time parameter. There are two options. The first is to promote time. And we have a position operator and a time operator. The problem with this approach, as you see with the homework, is that you still need a time parameter to describe time evolution. Could use proper time. That works, but that's not the only choice. And the ambiguities associated with the choice of time parameter, if you take this approach, make this approach more difficult, it can work. And in fact, generalization of this approach is one way to study string theory. And we'll come back to this in the string theory course. So string theory is essentially taking this route, but also adding, instead of just a time parameter, also adding another parameter, another spatial parameter. So this string theory does basically this, where we add an extra parameter. Instead of just time, we add a spatial parameter. So this can work. The easier route, which is the route we'll take, is to demote x. So in this case, both position and time are just parameters. This means we won't have a position operator, at least a position operator with all of the usual properties they're used to from non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And this will have some important implications. So it is possible to construct position operators in quantum field theory with some of the properties, but not all of them simultaneously. By the properties, I mean things like commutations with momentum and being self-adjoint. So this is the approach we're going to take, and this means there's no x hat operator. Okay. Any questions?
I'm thinking that maybe it's like a good thing not to have an X operator, because if I have an X eigenstate, then I have uncertain momentum and I can create like an infinity of particles or something like that.
Yes. Yes, there are problems with constructing an X hat operator that exactly localizes particles. What you can do is construct one that will localize particles within like their Compton wavelength. So the generalization of this X operator that basically does that. But yeah, exactly localizing particles in quantum field theory is problematic, as you pointed out. Thank you for the comment. Okay. Other question? Or comments? Key question you should keep in mind in this course and future courses when we're studying quantum field theory is, what can we measure? So you may think of physics as a method for taking a theory and making predictions. For measurements. Things we can actually measure. And this works in the cases we've seen so far. But in this course, we're going to sometimes need to think more carefully about, what do we mean by a theory? How are we specifying our theory? And perhaps a generalization of this way of thinking about physics that you are used to is that we should specify our theories by demanding that they agree with a finite set of measurements. So what we're doing in physics, I claim, is that we're taking as our input a finite set of measurements, which are guaranteed to be finite. Anything we can measure will be finite. And outputting predictions for other measurements, which will be finite. What's in here? How we specify the theory, how we relate this to the measurements, how we relate in either direction, may have some ambiguities. What won't be unambiguous is how we relate, how our theory maps the input measurements to all the output measurements. So to be more specific, you can imagine we have our theory is a theory of a ball and a gravitational potential. So that has two parameters, the strength of the gravitational field and the mass of the ball. And given that theory and some initial conditions, we make predictions for measurements. So in that case, our theory has two parameters, the mass and the strength of the gravitational fields. Those things are easy to measure. There's a direct way we can relate our measurements to the parameters of our theory. And that's the case for most of the theories you've studied so far. That will not be the case for all the theories we'll see in this course and future courses related to quantum field theory. This part, how to relate the parameters that specify our theory to our input measurements, is something we'll need to think carefully about. So previously this was often implicit. Well, we'll need to think about this explicitly. Another comment related to what can we measure in the context of quantum field theory is that intermediate quantities may be infinite. We have a valid physical theory as long as we can make predictions. We have a procedure that takes a finite set of measurements and outputs predictions for measurements. And the measurements must be finite. The things we use to the intermediate steps don't necessarily have to be. And that's just the way we're calculating things. So if we run into infinity, and we will very soon, starting tomorrow, in quantum field theory, that means one of two things. It means either the quantity we computed is not observable, or we made a mistake. Those are the only two possibilities. It's not physically reasonable for a prediction for a measurement to be infinite. Infinite measurements are ruled out. If there's an infinite force, we would notice. or an infinite mass, or anything we could measure being infinite is ruled out. We know physical measurements are finite. Things we use to calculate them might not be. You can construct ways where intermediate quantities that are unobservable arise in other contexts. It's unnatural in those contexts. For example, going back to our ball in a gravitational field, you could set your reference height. It's usually a way you would approach the problem is to introduce a coordinate system. You could introduce your coordinate system that's at a distance of minus infinity. You'd still do your calculations, and it's not a natural way to do it, but you could. You'd still end up with a finite prediction for where the ball ended up. In quantum field theory, we'll often find infinities in the natural way of doing a calculation. But it's not physical. It doesn't mean there's a problem with the theory. It either means quantity we computed is not something that can be measured, or we made a mistake. And so this is related to two terms you'll hear used later in the course, regularization and renormalization. I'll leave more precise definitions of these terms later, but just we have well-defined ways of dealing with these intermediate infinite quantities that sometimes pop up in quantum field theory. Okay. Any questions on that? So this should be weird. This is a new way of thinking about things, at least for many of you. Not often so far in your physics career, at least for many of you, that you've run into intermediate quantities that are. Okay, if there are no questions right now, an hour and a half is a long time to pay attention without a break, so let's take a 5-minute break. We'll resume in 5 minutes.
Intermediate quantities, do you mean some quantities that just pre-work in theory, like what we did for Fermi's golden rule? Because there's infinity, we tried to resolve it in Fermi's golden rule. Is that the quantity that you
That's like what I mean.
Okay.
In my example of a particle referencing infinitely far away, what can you actually measure? You can measure a displacement.
Oh, okay.
That would be fine, even if it's infinity minus infinity. You need to be careful about how you track different quantities, but regardless of where you choose the origin, the coordinate system, and the displacement.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh. He always wears his red jump on his own. Where's the left?
Delta
V is greater than 2m. Delta what? The energy. Do you know why it's 2m, not just m? I have no idea where you're going. Oh, there.
I know that here, China, like, it's cut off. I know that, like, half that.
Oh, yeah, it's bar 2. But if you remove the top stamp, where
you took the 2 out,
Dan, I've got a question. Where did the 2 come from in the delta E? It's greater than m.
If the uncertainty energy is twice the mass, well, there's two possibilities. There could be one very energetic particle or two particles.
Oh, right. But where did the 2 come from, just from your calculation?
For small enough l.
Oh, you just set l small enough, and it can
small
be
enough.
As big as you want.
I don't understand it yet because I'm not even doing this stuff, but I don't really.
This is such an interesting way of thinking.
Okay, let's resume. Any additional questions on the motivation.
Sorry.
Yes.
Define this word regularization and normalization.
I will. Yes, we'll discuss those.
I'm not very easy with what does this word mean. I mean, mathematically, you can say, okay, we encounter some infinity in interval, whatever calculation that we are doing, and we can put some cutoff into the intervals, and we can do something to fix it. But I mean, in physics, I don't know what does that mean, that we regularize in theory or.
This, we'll talk about this tomorrow. Regularization tomorrow. And renormalization next week.
Okay.
A little bit next week, more than last week. We'll have long discussions about this. I just wanted to introduce you to the terminology. Okay. So, starting point going to be classical field theory. And I just want to say a few words about notation and how to map our approach of canonical quantization to the canonical quantization that you are familiar with from non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So first, notation. So we are going to be exclusively studying scalar fields. So scalar fields, when we quantize them, will give rise to spin zero particles. And a scalar field is a function of space and time. So you can think of a field as a map from space-time to the real or complex numbers. For now, for today and tomorrow, we'll deal with just real scalar fields, but we'll quickly move to the complex case. And so my notation, so I'll indicate three vectors in one of three ways. So three vector, so I've drawn here, I can draw an x with a line over it. As an integration measure, I'll just write d3x. In the notes, or any types of material, including the tutorials or quizzes. Otherwise, the three vector is bold. Four vectors. On the other hand, I will indicate by an x with no vector symbol over it, or d4x, or italics. So I could write the scalar field as phi of x and t, or just phi of x. These are equivalent. Another point on notation I like to use is that we are going to be working with the, mostly minus signature. Gong will use the same signature in QFD1. It's somewhat more convenient for what we're going to do in these courses. In QFD2, we'll switch. So roughly half of the literature uses this signature and half of the literature uses the other signature. So it's good to have some familiarity with both. But I just want to inform you in advance that we will be switching roughly 7 or 8 weeks from now. So that means that our space-time integral is dt squared minus dx squared. Okay. That's our notation. And I want to make explicit the connection between the quantization procedure we're going to use and the quantization procedure you're familiar with from non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So one way we can construct a scalar field is through discretizing space and time. That's a useful technique that we may be useful for you in thinking about what we're doing in this course, and we'll explore that more in QFT too. It will give us some useful results thinking more explicitly about how to construct a continuum field from a model with discretized spacetime. So if we discretize spacetime. Here's time and space. Then a field configuration is specified by the value of the field at each point on this lattice. It will be specified by some the value of the field at each point, xi and tj. Those are the I and the j are labeling which point in the lattice we're at. Or we could use the four-vector notation as well. Now, in a we will discretize both space and time in QFT 2. For what I'm about to say, it would be easier if we leave time as continuous. Apologies. Okay. We'll leave time continuous. We'll just discretize space. So the configuration of our system at some given time t is specified by the value of phi at each point xi. And if we have a system of many particles, the state of the system will be specified by the position of each of the particles at a given time. So there's an analogy that will be useful in understanding the quantization procedure and a number of the results we're going to derive later. So the analog of the position of the particles is the field, not x. And this goes back to what I was saying about the non-existence of a position operator in quantum field theory. We're going to use the same procedure you're used to, or a slight generalization of it, for quantizing a non-relativistic system. But the analog of our position variable is the field variable, not our position variable. This will change a number of things. And the label A, which labels which particle, in the field theory system, the analog is the position, spatial position. So X here is really a label, the analog of position from the quantum mechanics system you're used to studying is the field, not the position. So we're going to use the Lagrangian formalism sometimes. And in particular, we're generally going to use the Lagrangian to specify our theory instead of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian will play an important role. You're quantizing a system, you want to ask about the time evolution of that system. The Hamiltonian is the operator that generates time translation. So you might think the natural starting point would be the Hamiltonian instead of the Lagrangian. We're going to start with the Lagrangian because it's very easy to ensure that we're starting with a Lorentz invariant theory. If we specify the Lagrangian instead of the Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian generates time translation, so Hamiltonian treats time and space differently. So the Lagrangians we'll consider are generalizations of Lagrangians you've seen before. So for a system of n particles, you might have studied a Lagrangian that was a function of the particles' positions, and their generalized velocities. The Lagrangians we will, and we could write an action by integrating this with respect to time. The actions we'll consider will be integrals of Lagrangians with respect to time. We're generally going to write them in terms of a Lagrangian density. And in an abuse of terminology, this is commonly referred to as just the Lagrangian. And Lagrangians we'll consider will be functions of the field. But not of at least an arbitrary function of the time derivative. We want to consider Lagrangians that are Lorentz invariant. we're interested in constructing relativistic theories where the theory preserves special relativity. So if we have a time derivative, we want time and space to be treated symmetrically, we should have four derivatives of the field. Lagrangians we'll be considering are generally of this form. And so here we have a invariant combination of space-time measure. And the Lagrangians we'll consider will also have manifest Lorentz invariants. And this form of Lagrangian imposes locality automatically. There are more general things we could consider that could preserve Lorentz invariants. Like we could write down an action that is of this form. So we could write a Lagrangian that's a function of two variables. We have 5x, 5y. So a Lagrangian in this form would be Lorentz invariant, could be Lorentz invariant, depending on the particular functional form you considered, but would not be local. We won't consider these more general forms. And Lorentz invariance is something you'll study much more with Gong. When you consider fields that have non-trivial Lorentz transformation properties. So we're only going to be interested in this course in scalar fields. So a scalar field is one that transforms trivially under Lorentz transformations. So we won't be discussing Lorentz transformations in great detail in this course.
First Lagrangian being local and the other one not local?
So implicitly here, this is a function of x. So each term in the Lagrangian will involve some power of phi to the x or times derivatives of phi to the x. So all the fields are evaluated at the same space-time point. Here, we could write down something where we have a term 5x, 5y, you're multiplying together two fields at different points in space-time. That's explicitly non-local. Okay. So in the Hamiltonian formulation, be useful when to describe time evolution. In non-relativistic quantum mechanics, if we have some generalized positions, QA, and their conjugate momenta, PB, the quantization procedure is to promote those to operators. We're going to do the same thing. Our approach is going to be the direct analog of what you're used to, but keeping in mind this mapping. So we are going to take our fields phi of x and their conjugate momentum, which I'll call pi, And promote those to operators. So field operator and its conjugate momentum operator. So this will be the conjugate momentum. This is not the same as the physical momentum, the momentum associated with translations, generates translations. These are different things. And here, conjugate momentum. That's here, pi. Is defined to be the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to phi dot. So this is just a time derivative, not a forward derivative. And this is related to the fact that when we're working in the Hamiltonian formulation, we've chosen a preferred time direction. When we're working in the Hamiltonian formulation, we're not dealing with the system in a manifestly Lorentz invariant way.
Can we convert between the Lagrangian density and the Lagrangian for the conjugate momentum definition?
Yes, sorry, this should be the density. Should be the density, sorry. But the Lagrangian is defined to be the spatial integral. Okay. I'd just like to make a brief comment about another theorem. So we'll occasionally use this result you studied with Aldo in quantum field theory. You derived it classically. And well, it's a theorem in classical mechanics. It can sometimes fail in quantum field theory. It won't usually in the theories we're going to study in this course in QFT1 and QFT2, but we'll discuss this more in QFT3. So we will occasionally apply this outside of, without checking carefully that it works in this course.
Dan, I have a question.
Yes.
Huh? You have written the field and the conjugate momentum as functions of the three vector. Why is that?
Sometimes we work in the Schrodinger picture or Heisenberg. So, sorry, I was not consistent here. We'll use both pictures at times. In the Schrodinger picture, the operators, field operators, will be time independent. The Heisenberg picture will also be independent. Thanks for the question.
The first theory we're going to study is known as Klein-Gordon theory, and it has the following Lagrangian. So this is a Lorentz invariant. Here there's no Lorentz transformation properties. Here we have the contraction of two four vectors theory. So it's a Lorentz invariant theory. It's local. So implicitly, I haven't written that explicitly, but implicitly the Lagrangian just depends on one space. Lagrangian density depends on a space-time point x, and all of the fields here should be evaluated at that same point, space-time point x. So it's of the type we're interested in. We're going to study this theory first because it can be solved exactly, both classically and in the quantum theory. That's a rare feature. Often to study quantum field theories, we're going to need to do perturbation theory around a theory we can solve exactly. And this is one of the few examples that can be solved exactly, at least involving scalar fields. And the basic reason for that is that there are no interactions in this theory. Classically, we can see that because the equation of motion is linear. The equation of motion, can anyone tell me what the equation of motion is for this theory?
Of the D'Alembertian minus, minus M.
Thank you. Okay. Plus. Thank you. So this is the equation of motion. It's linear in the field, which means we can solve it exactly. The fact that the Lagrangian is quadratic means we have a linear equation of motion. We can solve it exactly quadratically, and it also means we can solve it quantum mechanically. Interaction terms would involve higher order powers of the field. So it's just an example, but it's an important example.
Are there physical systems that follow this equation?
Exactly, no. There are physical systems that are close. If we had a physical system that was exactly like this, it wouldn't interact with itself or anything else. So there'd be no way to detect it, at least non-gravitationally. But we could construct construct theories that are close to this in a condensed matter context, or an example that is at leading order in perturbation theory, similar to this, although there are some differences, would be the Higgs boson. That would be a slight generalization as well. Okay, so this is the equation of motion. And it'll be useful when we quantize this theory to actually solve this. So let's do that today, and then tomorrow we will study the quantum version of this theory. So the simplest way I know of to solve this equation of motion is to do a three-dimensional Fourier transform. We could do a four-dimensional Fourier transform. It's not that much harder, but I think three-dimensional is a little bit easier. So we can write phi of x. And I'm always going to put my two pi's with the case. I'm going to do Fourier transforms. Okay. So if I plug this equation in here, I will get an equation that is phi double dot k t sorry, is it? Maybe there should be a minus. You're right. Minus k squared minus m squared.
I think you were right. I think it's a plus.
Plus. Yeah. Plus. Okay. Okay. We should end up with plus here. These having the same sign. I mean, I get the signs right. No. Plus, all pluses. Okay. There we go. Okay, so this. Yeah, so here we have a minus sign from the metric, and I squared from the derivative. Yeah. Sign. Okay, so this is our equation. Differential equation. It's a second order differential equation. Equation you all know the solution of. What's the solution to this equation? The second derivative plus some constants times the function is zero.
E to the I omega t, where omega is the square root of k squared plus some sort.
Very good. Thanks, Luke. So our solution is phi k t is two independent solutions. Where I called ek what you called omega. So ek here is
root of k squared plus m squared.
Just the energy of a relativistic particle. OK. So that's the general solution. But we're interested in the case where phi is real, at least for now. So we need to impose a reality condition. We should have that phi of x t is equal phi star x t. And that imposes a constraint or a relationship between A and B. In fact, it will show that details are in the notes. I won't go through all the algebra, but it should show that A of k is b star of minus k. And so that means the general solution can be written in this form. think I mixed up my definitions from the notes. I think I put the minus on here, my notes. Yes. So we have a minus here. And plus here. That's just a definition. It'd work the other way just for consistency with my notes. So this is our solution. This would work, but it has some not so nice features. We know this is a Lorentz invariant. Transforms trivially by definition. Over here we have a D3K, sort of D4K. In this exponent, well, there's a relative minus sign between the time and space term, so this term looks nice. This is good. I can rewrite this exponent as minus I k dot x with k0 equals ek. This term, we have the same sign, both. So that's not good. We can fix both of these problems. This is Lorentz invariant, the right-hand side, but it's not clear by looking at it. That's the case. Let's deal with this issue first. So we have the same sign here. So we want to flip the sign as one of the terms. And one thing we can do to flip the sign of the spatial term, the k dot x three-vector term, is do a change of variables. K goes to minus k. The energy is an even function of k, so it won't change signs. So here, if we do change of variables, this term becomes a star k e to the plus I k dot x. And then we have to worry about the overall sign. So when we do the change of variables, k goes to minus k, we get, for each spatial direction, we get a minus sign. But we also flip the limits of integration. And we undo the flipping of the limits of integration, we get a plus sign. So this is a plus. Even minus signs from measure and the limits of integration. Okay, so we've almost written it in a manifestly Lorentz invariant way. The only thing left to do is deal with the measure. And so we want to write the measure in terms of something manifestly Lorentz invariant. So we write it as a D4K over 2 pi to the fourth. Well, we've added an integration over the time component, zeroth component, energy component. So we need to remove that. Natural way to remove that is to add a delta, direct delta. And, well, we want the argument of the delta to be Lorentz invariant. If, and basically the only things we have are k squared and m squared. And we can write this as k0 squared minus k squared minus m squared. So this sets the argument of the delta is 0 exactly when k0 is equal to ek, which is what we wanted. So this enforces a condition we want. But here we have a delta of a function of k0. And the delta of a function of x, f of x, we get extra factors. Basically, if we want to rewrite this in terms of a delta of just an x, we'd have to do a change of variables, and that would have give us an extra Jacobian factor. So there's an identity here. You can write this as the sum over the root xi of delta of x minus xi over the derivative of f at each of those roots. And so here, the derivative of this is 2k0. So we need to put in a factor of 1 over 2k0, or ek. And there's two roots. We only want the positive root. We don't want k0 to be equal to minus ek, which is growing a Heaviside function. Now, this part doesn't look Lorentz invariant, but if we just restrict to Lorentz transformations that are continuously connected to the identity, they won't change the arrow of time. So we can rewrite our measure in this way. If we do that, we get 5x. This integral. I'll also do one other thing. I'll also absorb the factor of 1 over 2 ek in our definitions of the mode functions, ak. So I'll write these as some small aks over 2 ek. And with this redefinition, this identity, we can write the field as an integral d3k over 2ek. Oh, sorry. I put the 2ek in the wrong spot. Times 2ek. And I need to cancel off the 2 pi. We can write the solution to the Klein-Gordon equation in terms of this measure. We move the 2ek over to the other side. Get the d3k over with the 2ek on this side. Everything on the over here is manifestly Lorentz invariant. So this is Lorentz invariant. We get an AK e to the minus I k dot x plus a star of k e to the plus I k dot x, where this is evaluated where k naught is equal to ek. So this is our solution, and we'll use this to construct our quantum theory tomorrow. So once we quantize the theory, classical field will become a field operator. And these mode functions, A and A star, will become annihilation and creation operators that will annihilate and create particles. That's the first thing we'll do tomorrow, is quantize this theory. This solution will allow us to relate the field, which is the generalization of the generalized position. So we know how to quantize this. And we can then use that to construct operators that create or annihilate particles, which is what we're interested in. So this theory is the simplest theory we know. We can solve it exactly. But nevertheless, we're going to see some interesting and surprising features related to the question of what we can measure tomorrow. So that's where we're going. So that's all for today. I do value your feedback and questions. I have some feedback forms here if you'd prefer to leave feedback or ask questions anonymously. I'll leave these if you want to grab one and fill it out to provide comments or questions.